Father, we're grateful for this particular day on the church calendar where we celebrate your Son and what he did for us. And we're grateful for the fact that he didn't just leave us a collection of stories, but he actually did something real and historical through his bodily resurrection from the dead. And we thank you for that. We thank you that it's what gives us hope. And it gives us proof that Christianity is true. And help us, Father, to do justice to that doctrine today as we seek to teach it. And I just pray for everybody listening that live streaming would work fine. And I pray that people would hear this message and their hearts would be changed if they're unbelievers and they would turn to your Son, Jesus Christ, as the only way of salvation. We'll be careful to give you all the praise and the glory. We lift these things up in Jesus' name. And God's people said, amen. Let me invite your attention, if I could, this morning to John's Gospel. Gospel of John, chapter 1 and verse 14. And we had been teaching a couple of lessons through the book of Philippians, which we're going to put on hold this week, and we'll reconvene that study next week. Since today is a special Sunday, it's Resurrection Sunday, and so we're giving a special message here related to the resurrection of Jesus. And this is a message I've actually taught here before. As I was sort of praying about what to speak on, the Lord sort of redirected my thoughts this direction. And then, of course, as the Lord always does, he adds different things to it. But the title of this message is Jesus, One of a Kind. And if you look at John chapter 1, verse 14, this is what it says. It says, the Word, that's Jesus, became flesh and dwelt among us, and we saw his glory as of the only begotten from the Father, full of grace and truth. The translation only begotten is a fascinating word. It's the word monogenes in Greek. And if you look at that word in its different parts, mono you recognize from the word, maybe the English word monopoly, meaning alone or by itself. And of course, genus, basically, if you study biology, it basically means species or kind. And so that's the word that's used here to describe Jesus Christ. He is the monogenes. He is one of a kind. In fact, Jesus is the only man that has ever walked the face of this earth that is complete and totally unique. And one of the things I love about Christianity is God does not just appeal to our hearts. He makes an appeal to our intellect as well. And I come from the legal background. I'm one of those that thinks evidence and facts are very important. I know many of you believe that as well. And one of the things I love about Christianity is it appeals to that mind. And it says this man, Jesus Christ, factually is completely and totally unique. There are, in fact, seven strands of truth coming together in Jesus Christ that no human being ever in the history of mankind can ever claim. The last of which in our list is his bodily resurrection. But what I'd like to do with you this morning as we culminate the study in the bodily resurrection of Christ is just sort of to talk you through these seven areas or these seven categories. And I think as you walk away from this, you'll see that Jesus is the monogenes. He's completely unique. No one that ever lived before Jesus had these seven truths coming together in them, and no one can make that claim following the life of Jesus. Only Jesus Christ is unique in these seven things coming together cumulatively and simultaneously. So number one of our list of seven is Jesus is a man of verifiable history. A lot of people out there look at Jesus Christ as if he's just sort of a myth, a story, a collection of people made up. They look at Jesus Christ no different than they would any tale like Jack and the Beanstalk or Veggie Tales or some kind of comic book character, Superman, Spider-Man. But the reality of the situation is Jesus Christ really did live as a historical person. Christopher Hitchens, the late atheist, said this prior to his death. He said, Jesus of Nazareth is not a figure in history. There is no reason at all to believe that the so-called Jesus of Nazareth ever existed. Isn't that sad? Him having died in 2011, and I think as he's on the other side, probably has a completely different conclusion. But many people are like that. They just think Jesus is just a myth, something that somebody made up. And the reality of the situation is Jesus is a historical figure. On that point, there's absolutely no doubt. Because how do you know whether anybody existed? I mean, go back to George Washington and Abraham Lincoln. George Washington, of course, being before the photographic era. I mean, how do you know George Washington existed? Well, there's historical records indicating that he existed. And we have the exact same with Jesus Christ. This is what we call the New Testament. 27 New Testament books clearly indicating as a matter of history that this man Jesus Christ existed and that he walked the face of this earth. I, for one, think the New Testament record is very reliable and is very verifiable. Why? Because, first of all, it was written by devout Jews who held to the Ten Commandments, one of which is don't bear false witness. And the very authors of the New Testament went to their very deaths for the truths that they wrote about in the New Testament. It's very strange to me that someone would die for a fabrication or for a lie. Now, you might be asking yourself, well, do we have the original copies of the 27 New Testament books? And the answer to that is we do not have the copies originally. And a lot of people push the panic button and say, well, my goodness, if we don't have the actual copies of the 27 New Testament books, then how do we know that it's an authentic historical record? Well, there's actually some wisdom as to why God did not allow us to retain the 27 books originally that make up the New Testament. Think about this for a minute. If you have the original writings, then if somebody tampers with one of those original writings, then the whole cause of Christianity is lost. But if someone tampers with a copy, there could always be other copies. So things don't rise or fall according to whether someone tampers with the document. Beyond that, look at how people worship as idolaters things like the splinter. They think they find a splinter of the cross and they worship that. Think what the worship this would do if we only had the original documents. People would start to worship those things instead of God. So God actually, in his wisdom, allowed us to not preserve the 27 original New Testament books as original documents. So what then do we have? What we have are copies of the originals. And you might be surprised to learn that we have a ton of copies. Why do we have so many? Because Christianity, from its inception, has always been an evangelistic faith. The goal is to get folks saved. And so they took the originals and copied them over many, many times. And it's also interesting to learn that the distance of time between the original and the earliest existing manuscript is minuscule compared to other works of antiquity. So here's just a brief list here that demonstrates this. You have the writings of Caesar, and we only have 10 manuscripts of Caesar in terms of copies, and there's 1,000 years between the earliest Caesar manuscript that we have and when the original writing took place. Plato, there's a gap of 1,200 years and only 7 manuscripts. Thucydides, there's a gap of 1,300 years and only 8 manuscripts. Tacitus, there's a gap of 1,000 years and only 20 original manuscripts. Suetonius, a gap of 800 years and only 8 original manuscripts. Homer's The Iliad, a gap of 500 years and only 643 manuscripts. And look at the New Testament at the bottom there of the screen. We have 24,000 manuscripts, all of which agree with each other, probably at least 99% of the time. And look at the distance that we have between when the original was written and the earliest manuscript that we have. It's only a date of 25 to 50 years. So if you want to walk around and you want to challenge the historical authenticity of the New Testament, I mean, you have to throw out virtually every work of antiquity, Plato, Thucydides, Tacitus, Suetonius, etc., etc., etc. So what you're holding in your hands as the New Testament is not just a collection of tales. It's actually what any reasonable analysis would help us conclude, that it's a historical record. Now, beyond that, most people are very shocked to discover that the name Jesus Christ doesn't just show up in the Bible. It shows up in the works of secular historians, most of which really didn't have what I like to call a dog in the hunt or a dog in the fight. They weren't trying to prove something. They just knew that Jesus Christ was a historical figure. Here's, for example, the writings of Cornelius Tacitus in his Annals. He uses the word Christians. And he says Christians comes from Christus, Jesus in other words, for whom the name had its origin, suffered extreme penalty during the reign of Tiberius at the hands of one of our procurators, Pontius Pilate, and a mischievous superstition thus checked for the moment again broke out in Judea, the first source of evil. He goes on, but he talks here about Jesus, and he talks about this movement in Rome at the time called Christians. You see this in the writings of Josephus, a first century historian, who was a Jew that sort of is looked at as a traitor because he went to work for Rome. But Josephus says in his Antiquities, about this time there lived Jesus, a wise man, if indeed one ought to call him a man. For he is one who performed surprising deeds and was a teacher of such people as accept the truth gladly. He won over many Jews of the Greeks. He was the Christ. And when upon the accusation of the principal men among us, Pilate had condemned him to a cross, those who had first come to love him did not cease. He appeared to them, spending a third day restored to life, for the prophets of God foretold these things and 1,000 marvels about him. And the tribe of Christians, so called after him, has still to this day not disappeared. So we're not reading the Bible here. We're reading a secular historian. He mentions Jesus. He mentions the cross. he mentions the Christ and he mentions the movement that Jesus began called Christians. And if I had time to show you, I could show you similar statements in not just the writings of Tacitus, but Lucian, Suetonius, Pliny the Younger, Thallus, Marbar Serapion, and then of course Josephus, who I did mention. And notice when these historical figures wrote. They wrote, some of them in the end of the first century, some at the beginning of the second century, around the time of Christ. And so the reality of the situation is, whether you're talking about the 27 New Testament books that we have or the writings of secular historians, there is no doubt that Jesus actually walked the face of this earth as a real person, as a real human being. In fact, so certain is history on this that Jesus split the very calendar that we have since used. B.C., before Christ, A.D., year of our Lord, etc. So the first thing that makes Jesus unique is the first of seven things to think about is he was a historical character. Number two, Jesus was a man of fulfilled prophecy. Jesus is the only person that has ever walked the face of this earth who lived out a script written about him hundreds and in some cases thousands of years in advance. This is what Christ himself claimed. For example, if you look at John chapter 5, verse 39, Jesus says, "You search the scriptures because you think that in them you have eternal life. It is these that testify about me." Verse 46, "For if you believe Moses, you would believe me, for he wrote about me." And what he's saying is, my life is recorded in the writings of Moses, who wrote 1,500 years in advance. Jesus, after he rose from the dead, had sort of a conversation with the disciples on the Emmaus Road. And this is what it says in Luke 24, verse 27. "Then beginning with Moses and with all the prophets, he explained to them the things concerning himself in all the scriptures." Now he said, verse 44, these are my words which I spoke to you while I was still with you, that the things which are written about me in the law of Moses, the prophets, and the Psalms must be fulfilled. The law, the prophets, and the Psalms is what's called Tanakh, the three major divisions of Hebrew Bible. And what Jesus is saying here is those writings are speaking of me. Even Josephus makes a reference to this when he talks about Jesus the Christ. And he says here, the prophets of God foretold these things. He's acknowledging that Christ's life was written on a script before Jesus ever lived. You look here at these prophecies that were made to him, how he'd be born as a virgin. Isaiah 7, verse 14, written 700 years in advance. The place of his birth, Micah 5, verse 2, written 700 years in advance. His nationality as a Jew, not just a descendant of Abraham and Isaac, but descendant of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Revealed in the book of Numbers, chapter 24, verse 17, 1,400 years in advance. What tribe within the nation of Israel he'd be born into of the 12 tribes? The tribe of Judah. Genesis 49, verse 10, written 1,800 years in advance. And even the time of his announcement of his messiahship and the rejection of that messiahship by the nation of Israel is recorded in the book of Daniel, chapter 9, verses 25 and 26, 600 years in advance. And not only that, how Jesus would die is revealed long before he was born. Crucified between two thieves, Isaiah 53 verse 9, 700 years in advance. Pierced. Not stoned to death, but pierced. Written by Isaiah 700 years in advance. No broken bones. Psalm 22 verse 17, written 1,000 years in advance. The gambling that would be done for his clothing. Also in Psalm 22 verse 18, written 1,000 years in advance. Right down to his burial in the tomb of a rich man. Isaiah 53 verse 9, written 700 years in advance. This, by the way, is an extremely small sample. There are 109 of these prophecies. Here I'm just giving you a handful. And the prophecies are very, very specific. They're not just generic predictions like you find in the writings of Nostradamus or Gene Dixon. Not just generic things, but these are specific, concrete things. In fact, Peter Stoner, a statistician and a mathematician, speaks of how improbable, if not impossible, it is that just 8 prophecies could come to pass in one person's life. Dr. Stoner, a mathematician, calculated the probability that any one man could fulfill just 8 prophecies would be 1 in 10 to the 17th power. Meaning a 1 with 17 zeros after it. To illustrate how unlikely a chance that would be, Stoner gave this illustration. Cover the entire state of Texas with silver dollars to a level of 2 feet deep. The total number of silver dollars would need to be 10 to the 17th power. Now choose 1 silver dollar, mark it, put it back. Thoroughly stir all the silver dollars all over the state. Now blindfold someone and tell them they can travel wherever they want in Texas, but they must pick up the 1 marked silver dollar. The chance of finding that 1 silver dollar that we marked in a pile 2 feet deep covering the state of Texas would be the chance that the prophets had for these prophecies coming true in any one man. I mean, just to have 8 prophecies come together in a person is statistically not just improbable, but impossible, let alone 109. And one of the questions people ask is, well, how do we know that these prophecies were really written in advance? We know that categorically because we have something called the Septuagint, which is the Greek translation of the Old Testament. And that's on record close to 2 centuries before Jesus ever lived. Everybody acknowledges that. So there is a body of prophetic truth that was in existence minimum 200 years before Jesus ever existed. And beyond that, people say, and I've had people argue with me on this, well, how do we know Jesus didn't just go around and deliberately fulfill these prophecies to make it look like he was the Messiah? Well, it's kind of tough when it's predicting how you'd be born. I don't think we have much control over that, do we? Or the unique manner in which he would die. And yet Jesus is this very interesting figure, where this historical record in terms of a script is there before he ever lived. Now, think about this. Can any other religious character make that claim? I mean, to my knowledge, in the Quran concerning Muhammad, there are absolutely no prophecies like this written about him in advance. And any other figure of religious persuasion can make no similar claim. This is something unique to Jesus Christ. So not only was Jesus Christ a man of verifiable history, but he was also a man of fulfilled prophecy. Which takes us to number 3. Jesus was not just a man who fulfilled prophecy. Jesus was a man who made prophecy. He was a man of predictive prophecy. In fact, this is what he said in the upper room just prior to his death. He said in John 13, verse 19, "From now on, I am telling you before it comes to pass, so that when it does occur, you may believe that I am He." And then he says in chapter 14, verse 29, "Now I have told you before it happens, so that when it happens, you may believe." And what he said twice in the upper room is, "I'm going to make some short-term predictions, most of which are going to happen this very week, Holy Week. And when you start seeing these things happening, you're going to know exactly who I am." And so there are many predictions that Jesus made. He predicted, for example, that he'd be betrayed by a friend, John 13, verse 21. Of course, that was fulfilled in the traitor Judas. He predicted the threefold denial of Peter in Matthew chapter 26, verse 34 and verse 75. He said, "Peter, you're not going to betray me not once, not twice, not five times, not seven times. Three times, and it's going to happen tonight." He predicted how he would die in Matthew 20, verses 18 and 19. He said, "I'm going to be taken to Jerusalem. I'm going to be taken before the scribes and the Pharisees. They're going to hand me over to the Romans as an innocent person. The Gentiles are going to put me to death. First, they're going to scourge me, but they're not going to kill me. And then they're going to crucify me." And the whole thing happened exactly like he said it would happen just a few years later. He even predicted how his own disciples were going to die. He said in John 20, verses 18 through 22, "Truly..." John 21, excuse me, verses 18 through 22. "Truly, truly, I say to you," he's speaking to John, "when you were younger," or Peter, "you were younger, you used to gird yourself and walk where you wished. But when you grow old, you will stretch out your hands and someone else will gird you and bring you to where you do not wish to go." Now this he said, signifying what kind of death he would glorify God. And when he had spoken this, he said to him, "Follow me." Peter, turning around, saw the disciple whom Jesus loved following them, the one who also had leaned back on his bosom at the supper, and said, "Lord, who was the one that betrays you?" So Peter, seeing him, said to Jesus, "Lord, what about this man?" Jesus said to him, "If I wanted him to remain until I come, what is that to you? You follow me." It's an amazing prediction Jesus makes here. "Peter, you're going to be taken against your will. You're going to be taken to where you do not want to go." Likely speaking of the manner in which Peter would die to glorify the Lord. Tradition tells us that he was crucified upside down. I don't know if Peter really appreciated that prophecy 30 years before it happened. So he says, "What's going to happen to John?" And Jesus says to Peter, "Don't worry about John. I've got a different plan for John." What happened to John? Well, according to Tertullian in his Prescription Against Heretics, it speaks here of where John the Apostle was first plunged unhurt into boiling oil, and thence remitted to his island exile. What happened to John is they tried to boil him to death. He wouldn't die. Stubborn person, I guess. And consequently, they did to him what Domitian always did to troublemakers. He put him out on an island for exile. In this case, John was put on the island of Patmos. But that was actually the will of God, because it was there on Patmos that he would receive what we call, in terms of a vision, the book of Revelation. And what I want people to see is Jesus is predicting all of these things 60 years, 30 years before they happened. Peter, you're going to die one way. John, you're going to die a completely different way because God has a completely different purpose for you. And the predictions continue when Jesus also predicts what would happen in AD 70, an event that would occur about 40 years down the road. It says in verse 41, when he approached Jerusalem, he saw the city and wept over it, saying, if you had known in this day, even you, the things which make for peace, but now they have been hidden from your eyes, for the days will come upon you when your enemies will throw up a barricade against you and surround you and hem you in on every side. They will level you to the ground and your children within you, and they will not leave in you one stone upon another, because you, Israel, did not recognize the time of your visitation. It's an amazing prophecy about how the kingdom would not come in because of Israel's rejection of their king, Jesus, and how Israel would bear the consequences for that 40 years later by being invaded by Rome. And that's exactly what happened 40 years later, roughly, in AD 70. In fact, Christ's description of the AD 70 event here about your enemies forming a barricade against you lines up exactly with what Josephus reveals concerning the destruction that the Jews experienced at the hands of the Romans in AD 70. Jesus makes this statement here: they will not even leave one stone upon another. Speaking of the destruction of the temple and how you can go to the land of Israel today and you can see a fulfillment of that prophecy as the temple was literally torn apart brick by brick, exactly like Jesus said. Josephus tells us that essentially what happened is the temple during that terrible time of AD 70 got caught on fire and the gold in the temple began to melt. And it sort of oozed down between the bricks and dried there. And what did the Roman soldiers in greed do to get their hands on the gold? They took the temple apart brick by brick. That's exactly what Jesus said would happen. My point is simply this. Jesus is unique in terms of these predictions that he keeps making, most of which were fulfilled in the lifespans of those he was addressing. And if any one of those predictions had not worked out correctly, how could Jesus ever be accepted as the Messiah? How could he ever be revered? And how could he be held up with esteem and his name passed down through the generations? And by the way, if Jesus' short-term predictions happened, does that not give us confidence that the predictions he's also made that are yet to come from our time period, like those in Matthew 24 and 25, that those will be fulfilled as well? See, Jesus is completely special. He's completely unique. He's a man of verifiable history. He is a man of fulfilled prophecy. He is a man who made several minute predictions himself. But there's a fourth thing that makes Jesus very unique, is he's a man of unimpeachable morality. This is what Christ said in John chapter 8 and verse 46 to his enemies, to the very people that were trying to find anything they could whereby they might accuse him. In John 8 verse 46, he says, "Which of you can convict me of sin?" Now, that's quite a challenge to stand up in front of your opponents who hate your guts and want you dead and say, go ahead, look through my life. Find any skeleton you want in the closet and use it against me. I remember back in the 80s, one of our political figures said that to the press. And it wasn't long until, I think it took maybe a week, maybe a little less than a week, to discover all kinds of skeletons in that particular person's closet. Jesus said, find something on me, to his enemies. and yet they couldn't find anything. They had to manufacture lies against him to rush him through the Jewish judicial system to get him handed over to the Romans to get him dead. And it's interesting that Jesus has an inner circle. That inner circle, according to Matthew chapter 7, verse 1, consists of Peter, James, and John. These were people that knew Christ intimately. They had seen Jesus in every pressure-filled situation a human being has ever gone into. And they never found any problem with Christ's morality, his walk with the Lord. He never lapsed into unbelief. He never cursed God. In fact, Peter, one of that inner circle, writes these words 30 years after the life of Christ in 1 Peter 2, verses 21 through 23. He says, "For you have been called for this purpose, since Christ also suffered for you, leaving an example for you to follow in his steps, who committed no sin, nor was any deceit found in his mouth. And while being reviled, he did not revile in return. While suffering, he uttered no threats, but he kept entrusting himself to the one who judges righteously." John was also part of that inner circle. John was the one who, according to John 13, verse 23, leaned against the chest or the bosom of Christ in the upper room. And this is what John said about Jesus Christ in 1 John chapter 2, verse 1. He simply calls him Jesus Christ, the righteous. I mean, think about this for a minute. If some of your closest friends, your husband, your wife, your parent, your children, would write a book about you, could they ever make that kind of claim that you never sinned? Never at the point of pressure did you give up your faith? I mean, all of us, every human being fails under that standard. But not so Jesus Christ, as his closest friends and inner circle testify. What about Pilate? Pontius Pilate saw Jesus Christ in a situation where he was being completely and totally abused. And even Pilate himself says of Jesus in Matthew 27, verse 24, "I am innocent of this man's blood." By the way, Pontius Pilate, like Jesus Christ, is also a known character of history. He's not a myth. Tacitus refers to Pontius Pilate in his writings, as does Josephus. In fact, in Caesarea today, Caesarea Maritime, you can find what's called the Pilate inscription, a Latin inscription. It says, "Pontius Pilate, the prefect of Judea, erected a building dedicated to the emperor Tiberius." There's more historical evidence that what you're reading about in the Bible is not a myth. Pontius Pilate really existed, as did this man Jesus Christ. And Pontius Pilate himself, who watched Jesus in the most unfair of circumstances, said this man is completely innocent. How about the Roman centurion who watched Christ die in agony? What did he say about Jesus? It's recorded in Mark 15, verse 39, when the centurion who was standing right in front of him saw the way he breathed his last, he said, "Truly, this man was the Son of God." No break, no emotional letdown, no psychological break, no pattern of sin, no moment of unbelief. And that's who Jesus is. Take that standard and apply it to Muhammad and see how well it works. Take that standard and apply it to Jim Jones and see how long it holds up. Or Joseph Smith. Or Charles Taze Russell. or any other religious figure. All of them, as you look at them under a microscope, their blemishes, their blots, their immorality, their imperfection becomes very, very clear. Not Jesus Christ. He was a man of unimpeachable morality. This takes us to number five. Jesus is the monogenes. He is unique because he is a man of profound teaching. He unleashed upon the world the greatest teaching that humanity has ever received. I found this in a poem. I don't know who the author is, but it's called The Incomparable Christ, and this is what it says. He never wrote a book of Jesus. He never wrote a book. And yet all of the libraries of the country could not hold the books that have been written about him. He never wrote a song, yet he has furnished the theme for more songs than all the songwriters combined. He never founded a college, but all the schools put together cannot boast of having as many students. He never marshaled an army, nor drafted a soldier, nor fired a gun. Yet no leader ever had more volunteers who have under his orders made more rebels stack arms and surrender without a shot fired. He never practiced psychiatry, yet he healed more broken hearts than all doctors far and near. There's no doubt about it that Jesus Christ has unleashed upon this world 2,000 years ago a level of teaching and a level of morality which has never been seen before in the history of the human race. One of the things that's interesting about Jesus in terms of his teaching of ethics and his teachings about morality is he put morals into the heart. He didn't just say, don't do this or do this. He dealt with the heart of man like no other ethicist has ever done. He says in Matthew 5, verses 21 and 22, you heard the ancients were told you should not commit murder. And whoever commits murder shall be liable to the court. But I say to you that everyone who is angry with his brother shall be guilty before the court. And whoever says to his brother, you good for nothing, shall be guilty before the Supreme Court. And whoever says, you fool, shall be guilty enough to go into the fiery hell. He says a few verses later in this same sermon, the Sermon on the Mount, you've heard it said, you shall not commit adultery. But I say to you that everyone who looks at a woman with lust for her has already committed adultery with her in his heart. I mean, who has ever heard of that standard of morality? Where he's dealing with the inner motives of the human heart. This man Jesus is unique. I think you can find principles like this in the Mosaic Law. I found it not long ago in Leviticus 19, verse 18, but never did anybody take that heart standard and popularize it the way Jesus Christ did. The man Jesus Christ, they attempted to discredit him constantly. Matthew 22, verse 46 says this, after several hostile questions against Jesus, and he answered them with brilliance every single time. It sums it up and it says, no one was able to answer him a word, nor did anyone dare from that day on to ask him another question. What a profound philosopher this man Jesus Christ was. What a teacher. Matthew 7, verses 28 and 29 says, when Jesus had finished these words, the end of the Sermon on the Mount, in other words, the crowds were amazed at his teaching, for he was teaching them as one having authority, not as their scribes. And one of the things Jesus Christ did in his teaching is he claimed to be God himself. In John 10, verses 31 through 33, it says the Jews picked up stones to stone him. Jesus answered them, "I showed you many good works from the Father. For which of them are you stoning me?" The Jews answered, "For a good work we do not stone you, but for blasphemy, because you, being a man, make yourself out to be God." There's no doubt that Jesus claimed to be God. His enemies understood his claim that way. And that's why I appreciate what C.S. Lewis has developed called the logical syllogism of the Lord Lunatic Liar Trilemma. I remember when I was in Campus Crusade for Christ many years ago, we became very familiar with this. And essentially it's a logical syllogism which starts at the top saying Jesus claimed to be God. Now once he does that, you only have two choices here. It's true or it's false. And if it's false, you only have two choices. The first choice is he didn't know it was false, which would make Jesus a lunatic. I think C.S. Lewis puts it, he would be on the level of a poached egg. He would be insane. And yet, does Jesus seem insane to you? How could an insane person give the world the Sermon on the Mount, the highest ethics and morality the world has ever seen? Well, if it was false, maybe he knew it was false, which would make him a liar. But why would he be a liar? Because he went to his grave for the lie. People die for the truth, but they don't die for a lie, which takes you to the opposite side of him, opposite side of this. The only reality left is that his claim was true. And he was God. Which means we have two choices. We can either reject it or we can accept it. And so it's a marvelous teaching simply showing the mastery of Jesus Christ and the profound nature of his teaching. Not only was Jesus a man of history, not only was he a man of fulfilled prophecy, not only was he a man of predictive prophecy, not only was he a man of unimpeachable morality, not only was he a man of profound teaching, but he was a man of miracles. He performed signs and wonders. In fact, John chapter 3 verse 2 tells us that that was the reason Nicodemus, the teacher of the Jews, was attracted to the ministry of Christ. It says, "This man came to Jesus by night and said to him, 'Rabbi, we know that you have come from God as a teacher, for no one can do these signs that you do unless God is with him.'" John the Baptist began to sort of lose heart that Jesus was the Messiah, languishing in prison. And John the Baptist sent some of his people to inquire of Jesus, "Are you really the Messiah?" And you'll notice that Jesus here in that inquiry appeals to his miracles. It says, "Now when John," Matthew 11, 2 through 6, "while in prison, heard of the works of Christ, he sent word by his disciples and said to him, 'Are you the expected one, or should we look for someone else?' Jesus answered and said to them, 'Go and report to John what you hear and what you see. The blind receive sight, the lame walk, the lepers are cleansed, and the deaf hear. The dead are raised up, the poor have the gospel preached to them.'" And then he says, "Blessed is he who does not take offense at me." Don't let your faith lapse, John, even though things are not proceeding the way you think they should proceed. I'm the guy. I'm the Messiah. I'm the one you've all been waiting for. And you can see that through my signs. In Mark chapter 4, verses 38 through 41, it says this: Jesus himself, in the midst of a storm on the Sea of Galilee, was asleep on the cushion. And they awoke and said to him, "Teacher, do you not care that we are perishing?" And he got up and he rebuked the wind and said to the sea, "Hush and be still." And the wind died down and it became perfectly calm. And he said to them, "Why are you so afraid? Do you still have no faith?" And they became very much afraid and said to one another, "Who is this that even the wind and the sea obey him?" Peter, on the day of Pentecost, preached to the Jews, telling them that they had executed their own Messiah. And in the process, Peter makes an appeal to the miracles of Christ. He says, "Men of Israel, listen to these words. Jesus the Nazarene, a man attested to you by God with miracles and wonders and signs, which God performed through him in your midst, just as you yourselves know." In fact, the whole Gospel of John revolves around the signs of Christ. John 20, verses 30 and 31 says, "Therefore many other signs Jesus performed in the presence of his disciples, which are not written in this book, but these have been written so that you might believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name." Jesus is the real thing, as evidenced by his signs. There were seven signs performed in John's gospel, recorded there for us to see eyewitness testimony who Jesus actually was. John 2 verse 11 says, "The beginning of his signs was the water to wine at Cana." The second sign, John 4, verse 54, was the healing of the nobleman's son. And it goes right on down this list and gives you a list of seven. I mean, there's no doubt about it that Jesus was a man of miracles. He performed signs and wonders. In fact, the miracles of Christ were so real that his enemies could not dismiss those miracles. Matthew 12, verse 24, after one of the miracles of Christ, it says, "But when the Pharisees heard this, they said, 'This man casts out demons only by Beelzebub, the ruler of demons.'" And in that accusation, they're admitting they can't dismiss the sign. It's open, it's obvious, it's transparent. It happened. So they simply said he was doing these things by Satan's power. Even Josephus himself recognized the signs of Christ in the quote I read to you earlier. The first part of it concerning Jesus the Christ says, "About this time there lived a wise man, if indeed one ought to call him a man, for he was one who performed surprising deeds." In other words, Josephus is acknowledging here that this man, Jesus Christ, was a miracle worker. And we move here to the conclusion of our message as we talk for just a moment about his ultimate sign. The sign that we're here on the Lord's Day celebrating. Jesus was a man who was, on the third day, even Josephus picks up on this, a man restored to life. So, and think about this as we are marching through this list, how these things coming together in one person, how unique that makes Jesus Christ. Jesus was a man of verifiable history. He fulfilled a pre-written script written about him in terms of Bible prophecy. He made predictions of his own, of a short-term variety that people could easily validate. His morals were unquestionable by those most intimately connected to Him. He unleashed upon the world the greatest teaching, ethics, and philosophy the world has ever seen. He was a man of authentic miracles. And there's just one more thing that He did, as if everything else on this list is not enough. He said in John chapter 2, verses 18 through 22, I'm going to be killed, after describing how He would be killed. And then He says, I'm going to rise to life. The bodily resurrection. John 2, verses 18 through 22 says, the Jews said to Him, what sign do you show us as your authority for doing these things? Jesus answered them, destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up. The Jews then said, it took 46 years to build this temple, and will you raise it up in 3 days? But He was speaking of the temple of His body. So when He was raised from the dead, His disciples remembered that He said this, and they believed the scripture and the word which Jesus had spoken. It's one thing to predict that you're going to rise from the dead after you're killed. It's a completely different thing to actually pull it off. And yet, that's what Jesus Christ did. The empty tomb is one of the most well-attested facts of history. So well-attested is the empty tomb and the resurrection of Jesus that the Jews, who had been worshiping on Saturday for 1,500 years, the last day of the week, the Jewish converts in this new movement of Christianity, which would later be described Christianity, the Jews, Christianity started with Jewish believers. They switched the Sabbath, or the day of worship, from the last day of the week to the first day of the week. Now, why would they switch their tradition unless something monumental had happened? And that monumental thing that happened is Jesus rose from the dead that Sunday morning. Paul the Apostle, it's very interesting, makes this statement as he's discussing the implications of the resurrection. The Corinthian church, falling under philosophical Gnosticism, started to deny resurrection. Paul writes a whole chapter, 1 Corinthians 15, to explain to them the reality of the resurrection. Paul says this, and I would encourage you to read that chapter today. It's one of the greatest chapters you could ever give yourself on this particular day on the calendar. It says this, after that, Paul recording history, he appeared to more than 500 brethren at one time. Now watch this. Most of whom, when Paul wrote this about AD 57, most of whom remain until now, but some have fallen asleep. Then he appeared to James. And then to the apostles, Paul goes on and he says, he appeared to me. But in the process of describing the folks that Jesus appeared to, he talks about 500 people that Jesus appeared to. And then Paul makes this amazing statement, go ask them. I mean, most of them are still alive. Now, think about this for a minute. What if people had gone out and asked these 500 and found it to be false? How could the book of Corinthians ever been accepted by the Christian church? How could it ever been respected? How could it ever been revered? How could it ever been passed down through the generations? It would be like me writing a book that said John F. Kennedy died of natural causes. Well, wait a minute. There were people that actually saw Kennedy die. He was fatally shot, as you know, in Dallas. And they would say, well, your book is factually wrong. And so my book would be discredited right out of the gate because it doesn't fit with what the eyewitnesses saw. That's how you look at 1 Corinthians. I mean, Paul is extremely bold and says there's 500 of these. Most of them are still alive. Go ask them. And if that had proven to be false, you would have a discredited 1 Corinthians. And think about this for a minute. Do you know how easy it would have been to stop Christianity? There were people that hated Christianity when it started. How do you stop this new movement? You know how you stop it? You just go into the tomb and you bring the body out. He's still here. He died and there's his corpse. All of this resurrection stuff is a hoax. I mean, it would have been very simple to halt Christianity immediately, but the enemies of the cross, the enemies of Christianity, the enemies of Jesus, the enemies of the way never did that. You know why they never did it? There was no body in the tomb. The objective truth of the empty tomb is a historical fact. So what people are left with is coming up with naturalistic theories to explain away the evidence of the empty tomb. Very, very quickly, the first theory that they use is called the swoon theory, which is this idea that Jesus never really died. He appeared to be dead, but he wasn't dead, and he kind of snuck out in the middle of the night. How many problems can we poke in that theory? John tells us he died. John writes this in John 19:32-34. So the soldiers came and broke the legs of the first man and the one who was crucified with him. But coming to Jesus, when they saw that he was already dead, they did not break his legs. But one of the soldiers pierced his side with a spear, and immediately blood and water came out. There are medical doctors that say the separation of water and blood is symptomatic of a ruptured heart, symptomatic of death. I mean, there's no doubt that Jesus died. That was the job of the Roman soldiers, to make sure that he was dead. And if he wasn't dead, how could he have moved the massive stone and come out of that tomb in sort of a semi-comatose state and convince the disciples that he was the resurrected Messiah? The whole thing is ridiculous. And that's what happens with these naturalistic theories, is it takes more faith to believe the theory than simply to believe that Jesus rose from the dead. Then, of course, there's the theft theory. Rome stole the body. But why would a Roman soldier steal the body when going into a sealed tomb brings you the penalty of death? Well, maybe the Romans didn't steal the body, but the Jews stole the body. Why would the unbelieving Jews steal the body? They didn't want to make it sound as if Christianity is true. They had a vested interest in keeping people away from this man, Jesus Christ. Why would they assist and make it look like the resurrection happened? And then people say, well, the disciples stole the body. Think about this. Think about how the disciples died. Think about the barbarous martyrdoms that they experienced. Why would they go to their graves with a fabrication? People die for the truth, but they don't die for something that they manufacture. Another theory, of course, is the hallucination theory. Everybody saw a hallucination of the resurrected Christ. Medical experts tell us that when someone sees a hallucination, that hallucination is unique to them. How could 500 people see the exact same hallucination at the exact same time period? And the last one is what's called the wrong tomb theory. The reason the tomb was empty is everybody went to the wrong tomb on Sunday morning. Now, I could see one person going to the wrong tomb or two people, but all of them, I mean, they all knew where the tomb was. It's like the tomb of where your parents or your grandparents or your loved ones are. You know where that tomb is because that person is special to you. And this Jesus Christ was special to all these individuals. And so the idea that all of them, not one or two, all of them went to the wrong tomb is, again, another example of it takes more faith to believe something like that than it does to believe the simple truth that Jesus rose from the dead. The bottom line is Confucius' tomb is occupied, as is Buddha's and Muhammad's, but Jesus' tomb is empty. And that's a historical fact. And so what we see in this study is Jesus Christ is completely and totally unique. Never have you had a historical figure where these seven strands of truth come together in that person simultaneously. He was a man of verifiable history. He was a man of fulfilled prophecy. He was a man of predicted prophecy. He was a man whose morality could not even be questioned. He was a man of profound teachings and authentic miracles. And if all of that weren't enough, he was a man who rose bodily from the dead. And one of the things he says throughout John's gospel is he makes seven I am statements. He's using the Greek expression ego a me, I am, which is a title that belongs only to God, as you'll find in Exodus chapter 3, verse 14. Jesus is claiming to be God, and he's not just claiming to be God, but he's going a step further, and he's appealing to the rational mind that in fact he is God. And in one of those I am statements, he makes this statement here in John 11, 25 through 27. And with this we'll conclude. Jesus said to her, I am, ego a me, the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me, even if he dies, I think I misread that. He who believes in me will live even if he dies. There we go. Verse 26. And everyone who lives and believes in me will never die. And then he says, do you believe this? She said to him, yes, Lord, I have believed that you are the Christ, the Son of God, even he who comes into the world. And that question that he asks to her, do you believe this, is the same question that we could ask today. I mean, it's one thing to hear a bunch of data about Jesus. It's completely different to actually believe the data to the point where you're trusting in him for your eternity. So help this not to be an Easter Sunday message where we just learn a lot of facts and information about Jesus. Help it to be life transforming, where if you hear this, you're actually trusting in the message of Jesus Christ, and you can do that right now as I'm speaking and be a newly born creature on this special day on the Christian calendar. So that's our exhortation, is for people to believe the gospel. Believe means to trust. You trust in its message and it alone for the safekeeping of your soul. If it's something you need help with, send us an email or put a message there on Facebook so that we can talk to you. And so to conclude, we conclude with this benediction. May the Lord bless you and keep you. May the Lord make his face shine upon you and be gracious to you. May the Lord turn his face towards you and give you peace. God bless you. You're dismissed.